Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, who assesses the UN report on the use of chemical weapons in Syria and how the U.S.-Russian agreement to destroy Bashar al-Assad's chemical arsenal could lead to peace talks on ending Syria's civil war. Mattia Kramer of the National Priorities Project, who talks about her group's new study revealing how tax breaks and loopholes have grown, diverting money to the wealthy that could otherwise benefit Americans in need. And Richard Eskow of the Campaign for America's Future, who explains why the current record level of U.S. income inequality is a predictable result of economic policies designed to benefit the richest 1%. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Four young men from India were convicted in the gang rape of a 23-year-old woman last December, which triggered global outrage over widespread violence against women in India. Limited legal reforms provoked by the case included new laws making stalking and voyeurism a crime and increasing penalties for rape. The four men, who grew up in rural India and moved to New Delhi to find work, were convicted of rape, kidnapping, and murder, and sentenced to death. Prominent New Delhi women's advocate Rebecca John stated, "We can celebrate this particular case, but change is a much larger issue. Let us mourn for the other cases that were not highlighted." Across Asia, a quarter of all men in a new survey admitted to committing rape sometime during their lives. The United Nations-sponsored study surveyed over 13,000 men and women between the ages of 18 and 49 in Bangladesh, China, Cambodia, Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, and Sri Lanka. The survey found that younger boys who were sexually abused are more inclined to engage in sexual violence and gay bashing later in life or to practice unsafe sex. Russian dissident Alexei Navalny surprised the Kremlin establishment by winning over 27% of the vote in the September 8th election for Moscow's mayor, only 5 weeks after he was convicted of embezzlement and sentenced to 5 years in prison in a trial his supporters charged was politically motivated. Although the neophyte candidate had a strong showing, it was not enough to oust current Moscow mayor Sergei Sobyanin, who won 51% of the vote. Navalny refused to accept the official results, asserting that his internal polls showed he had won enough votes to force a runoff. The lawyer and blogger, who was shunned by the state-owned media, waged an aggressive grassroots campaign to expose the corruption of President Putin's United Russia Party. He has threatened to take his protest over the election results to the streets. Navalny's surprising vote total appears to have had some side benefits. His rising popularity makes it difficult for Russian authorities to give him a long prison sentence. Further, Putin's United Russia Party demonstrated it has become increasingly vulnerable to aggressive reformers in Moscow and other cities. Opposition parties generally did well in local elections across Russia this year, including winning the mayor's race in Yekaterinburg, Russia's fourth largest city. Milwaukee pediatrician David Walker now bikes to work to his inner-city medical practice every day, giving him more time out of the office. Dr. Walker sang the praises of two-wheel non-motorized transportation, observing that biking takes you out of the box. It lets you hear, smell, and experience the world around you. The racks of blue bikes across New York City, part of the newly inaugurated Bike Share program, is the latest sign of the growing popularity of urban biking as a low-cost, healthy transportation alternative. The new popularity of biking can be seen in many smart-growth cities like Portland, Oregon, Seattle, and Miami. In many U.S. cities, bike commuting is becoming easier as local officials expand the use of bike lanes and set up bike rental programs. Over the last year, the number of cities offering bike share programs like New York City has doubled. But according to the Christian Science Monitor, despite the new popularity of urban biking, only 1% of trips in the U.S. are taken with a bike. In contrast, the publication says, in the Netherlands, over a quarter of all trips involve a bike. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The first independent investigation into the alleged use of chemical weapons in Syria's civil war was released by the United Nations on September 16th. While the report did not issue a finding on which side was responsible for the use of chemical weapons, it did conclude that surface-to-surface rockets filled with the deadly nerve agent sarin were likely launched from positions controlled by the Syrian government and killed hundreds of civilians in the Damascus suburb of Ghouta on August 21st. However, casting doubt on any solid conclusion about who used chemical weapons, the UN report noted that while their investigative team was at the Ghouta attack site under the control of rebels, quote, individuals arrive carrying other suspected munitions, indicating that such potential evidence is being moved and possibly manipulated, unquote. Responding to a Kremlin initiative, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov concluded an agreement to place Syria's chemical weapons under international control. Under the timeline, chemical weapons-related production facilities and equipment will be destroyed by this November, and all chemical weapons material are to be eradicated by mid-2014. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon expressed hope that the U.S.-Russian agreement on controlling and destroying Syria's chemical weapons could spur a new diplomatic effort to negotiate an end to Syria's bloody 2.5-year-long civil war that has killed more than 100,000 and displaced millions of refugees. Your reporter spoke with Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, who assesses the UN report on the use of chemical weapons in Syria and how the U.S.-Russian agreement on destroying Bashar al-Assad's chemical weapons could lead to peace talks on ending Syria's civil war.
You know, this was a long report, a 40-page report that was released by the UN team. That team had a very narrow mandate. Their mandate originally was simply to confirm whether it was a chemical weapons attack and what kind of chemicals were used and, if possible, how they were used, what kind of distribution system was involved. And what they determined was that, yes, it was sarin. They did not come up with a figure of how many people were killed. They interviewed survivors. They were not in a position to determine how many people had died. People had already been buried. And there's indications, this was in the press a couple of days ago, that the figure that the U.S. used, that very precise 1,426, I think it was, actually didn't represent only people killed by the chemical weapons, but people who were killed by chemical weapons and people who were killed in that same area by conventional bombing that followed. Now, what's interesting about the UN report is that it does confirm it was sarin gas. They say that they have indications that it was used in rockets, and they found pieces of these rockets and found sarin residue on them in the areas where the largest numbers of people were sickened and killed in those attacks. But they went on to say that even while they were there, during the time spent in these locations, individuals arrived carrying other suspected munitions, indicating that such potential evidence is being moved and possibly manipulated. So that's the position of the United Nations. The U.S. position immediately was, this proves it was done by the regime because only the regime would have had access to these kinds of rockets, which certainly is possible. It's certainly one possibility, but it's by far not anything conclusive in the U.N. report about who used them. That wasn't their mandate. They didn't make any finding about that. And the finding that the evidence may have been manipulated is a pretty good indication that this is not anything we could use to actually determine culpability. It seems to me there should be a second United Nations team sent with a mandate to determine who was responsible, something that we haven't had so far.
As many commentators have said, the Russians really threw President Obama a life raft for his drowning initiative to get Congress to approve a bombing strike on Syria. But, you know, there's a lot of talk now that if the United Nations Security Council resolution doesn't contain any provision for using force to make Syria comply, that Obama may judge the process to be unworkable at some point here and could go back to Congress or not go to Congress at all and strike out using drones or cruise missiles or what have you to bomb the Syrian military. Is that something that you're concerned
Absolutely.
Might
happen? Those are very possible options. They would be illegal, immoral, dangerous in all the ways that we said a strike would have been illegal, immoral, and dangerous 2 weeks ago. They still would be, even if there was absolute noncompliance, let alone if there was some small technical noncompliance. They would be immoral because they would be almost certain to cause greater civilian casualties, and they would be dangerous because they would further destabilize an already thoroughly unstable region. But I think that's where it comes back to the role of anti-war forces. You know, this has been a huge victory, unexpectedly, for a resurgent anti-war movement that I think many of us were shocked to see reemerged. And we have to remain on guard. We have to remain prepared to keep up the pressure on Congress, that if it is brought back to Congress, that the no vote that was about to happen stay where it is and still be a no vote, and keep up the pressure on the U.S. to move towards forceful diplomacy rather than military force.
For the moment, there has been the triumph of diplomacy. Russia picked up the ball, and Obama has run with it thus far, trying to come to some agreement on the chemical weapons end of it. But the civil war goes on. Over 100,000 people have been killed in this 2.5-year civil war. What are the chances that the on-again, off-again talks in Geneva could resume and reach some kind of substantive agreement that could end the hostilities or at least a temporary ceasefire while
this
talks
is
get
all
underway?
Dependent on the U.S. and Russia. They are the main powers here. If they had the political will to do it, the meeting would be convened next week. Russia would insist that Iran and Iraq be present with them. The U.S. would insist on Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, and Jordan being present with them. And those two sides would insist that their relative Syrian partners be at the table. That means it would be a very big, messy table. The Syrian opposition would be represented by God knows who, a weird conglomeration of Islamist and secular armed forces. And what we would have to be fighting for is the presence of the truly heroic, but often unheard and usually ignored, remnants of the original Syrian political opposition that amazingly continue to protest, continue to go out into the streets with banners saying no to the regime, no to oppression, no to foreign intervention, no to U.S. airstrikes, and have them at the table as well. Their voices, unfortunately, have largely been drowned out by the incredible violence of the Civil War.
That was Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Find more analysis and commentary on Syria's civil war by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Each year since 1974, the White House releases an estimate of the cost of all federal tax breaks, also known as subsidies and tax loopholes. The nonpartisan Nonprofit National Priorities Project has recently completed a groundbreaking analysis of these federal tax breaks over the past 38 years, revealing they have grown in number and size, diverting money that could otherwise be used to benefit Americans in need. The study of tax loopholes is in keeping with the National Priorities Project's mission to make our complex federal budget transparent and accessible so people can exercise their rights and responsibilities to influence how their tax dollars are spent. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Mattia Kramer, research director with the National Priorities Project, who explains that this year's tax breaks cost the U.S. government an estimated $1.13 trillion, just slightly less than all discretionary spending, and substantially more than the budget deficit during the same year. In this third week of September, which marks the second anniversary of the Occupy Wall Street movement, Kramer explains that the richest 1% benefit the most from the existing tax code and proposes changes to make the U.S. system of taxation more fair and equitable.
Many, many Americans benefit from tax breaks of different kinds. The question is, are we benefiting equally or are certain folks benefiting more than others? And what we found is that many of the top tax breaks, which account for the vast majority of the cost of all tax breaks to the federal government, these top tax breaks are tilted heavily in favor of the wealthy. So there's some egregious examples. For instance, there's a special low tax rate on capital gains and dividend income, and that tax break costs the federal government about $83 billion this year, so a huge sum of money. And nearly 70% of that total goes to the top 1% of income earners. So in other words, this is a huge boon in terms of tax savings for the top earning or the wealthiest Americans.
How long have these tax breaks been on the books, and how did they get on the books?
Sure. Well, many of them have been on the books in one form or another for many decades. The largest tax expenditure out there is the exclusion of employer-sponsored health care. And I know that sounds really obscure. And in fact, it's a tax break that anybody who gets health care through their employer benefits from. What it means is that we can pay for health care with pre-tax dollars. And so we don't typically ever see that tax break, but it is the largest one. It costs the federal government about $200 billion a year. That tax break has been on the books for many decades, and in fact, it's intertwined with the history of health care in this country, in which the government wanted to subsidize health insurance and decided to do so by making employer-sponsored health insurance more affordable.
That sounds like it covers a lot of people, so not just the top 1%. And many Americans at the lowest income levels would be eligible for Medicaid. So would you consider that a progressive tax break?
Well, I don't agree that it's a progressive tax break. It is less regressive, far less regressive than many of the other tax breaks, but it's not progressive in the sense that the majority of the benefits don't go to those who are the least well off. So it still heavily benefits wealthy Americans, but it certainly does far more than many of these other tax breaks offer benefits to middle and low-income folks. I don't think necessarily that this tax break ought to be substantially reformed, but I do think it's important to acknowledge that the federal government is spending $200 billion a year on this type of subsidy, and you know, absolutely it's an important objective to make sure that Americans can afford health insurance, but this tax break only reaches folks who already have employer-sponsored health care. So it does nothing, of course, for folks who work for themselves or don't have a job.
Mattia Kramer, can you discuss one or more of the tax subsidies that the National Priorities Project would like to see either reformed or eliminated?
Oh, absolutely. Well, the largest corporate tax break allows corporations to defer paying taxes on income earned abroad. And so that means that if corporations attribute, you know, X millions or billions of dollars in income to their operations in Europe or Asia, they don't have to pay U.S. federal taxes on that money unless they bring it home. And what it does effectively is it creates an incentive for corporations to keep billions of dollars, in some cases, in cash overseas. So we think absolutely that that could be an opportunity ripe for reform. It doesn't seem to make sense from a number of perspectives, and it costs the federal government about $40 billion this year.
Does any other one stand out as especially unfair?
Well, I mentioned a bit earlier the special low rate on capital gains and dividend income. So this is a special tax rate for a certain kind of income, income earned on investments, essentially. And what it means effectively is that folks who earn their living by investing money pay a lower tax rate than folks who earn their living by working. And the purpose behind that tax break is to encourage investors to take the risk of investing. But the upshot is that very wealthy individuals sometimes end up paying a tax rate that's much, much lower than their middle-class peers. And so we heard this sort of famously in the 2012 presidential election when we heard that Mitt Romney paid a tax rate of something like 13%, and that's because he's someone who earns his income from investment income. And so that's another tax break, this special rate on capital gains income, that absolutely could be an opportunity for reform. And that costs the federal government about $83 billion this year. That's a lot of money. By way of comparison, the federal government spends this year about $68 billion on all education programs. So that gives you a bit of comparison there for scale.
Now that you have all this valuable data, what do you want to see happen?
What we have to ask ourselves as a nation, and certainly Washington ought to be wrestling with, is do we want all of these tax breaks in our tax code, right? So they're costing the federal government more than $1 trillion in lost revenue this year. And that's at a time when we're seeing budget cuts across the board. And those cuts are affecting things like public education, food safety, the criminal justice system, you name it. So do we want more than $1 trillion in potential government resources dedicated to these tax breaks? And so tax reform, which Congress is now considering, tax reform must evaluate each of these tax breaks, who benefits and why and at what cost.
That was Mattia Kramer, Research Director with the National Priorities Project. Visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org, where you'll find a link to the group's Big Money in Tax Breaks report. Although income inequality has been rising in the United States over the last 30 years, a new report from economists at the University of California at Berkeley, the Paris School of Economics, and Oxford University have found that the wealth gap has now reached record levels. According to analysis of data from the Internal Revenue Service, the top 1% of earners in the U.S. pulled in 19.3% of total household income in 2012, the largest share for the nation's wealthiest citizens in more than 100 years. The next highest share of wealth taken by the richest was recorded in 1927 at 18.7%, 2 years before the start of the Great Depression. According to the study, incomes among the top 1% rose by 31.4% between 2009 and 2012, while incomes for everyone else grew just 0.4%. The top 10% of earners in the economy now control more than half the nation's total income. While the majority of Americans struggle to recover their losses from the Great Recession that brought with it high unemployment, underemployment, diminished wages, and unsustainable debt, the wealthiest Americans have recouped almost all of what they lost as the gap between rich and poor gets ever wider. Your reporter spoke with Richard Eskow, a former Wall Street executive who is now a senior fellow with the Campaign for America's Future. Here he analyzes the data on record income inequality, the economic policies that predictably led to this disparity, and the changes necessary to reverse course.
We're seeing increasing accumulation of enormous wealth at the very top, that the curve is getting very much bent in favor of those who are already doing well. But not only are we seeing the top 1% at a level percentage-wise that we haven't seen since 1927, which was right before the Great Depression, but we're also seeing the top 10% earning more than half the nation's income, more than the remaining 90%, for the first time since they started tracking this data at all, which was 100 years ago. The top 1% saw their income increase by nearly a third year over year in just 1 year. The significance of this is the rest of the nation has not seen its income increase at all at the top level since the financial crisis of 2008, which hurt a great many Americans, put a great many out of work, and we've seen stagnating wealth for the vast majority of people. So we're getting a more and more unfair economy, and that's not by accident. It's not because that's the way God intended it. It's not because that's how the natural forces of the economy work. It's because our government, which has been increasingly influenced by big money forces, has made a series of decisions that have brought us to this point, and a large majority of people are losing out as a result.
As you point out, wealth redistribution from the poor and the middle class to the wealthy elite is not an accident. Maybe you can specify some of our nation's economic policies over recent decades that are responsible for, say, the current record levels of income inequality.
Well, one of the most striking statistics, and again, this is a result of decisions made at the government level, the real corporate tax rate, not the one that's on the books, but the real rate that corporations pay once they're done exploiting all the loopholes they've been given and so on, is at the lowest it's been, or as near the lowest it's been in 60 years, even though corporate profits, the amount of money they're making, are near their 60-year high. So they're making more money, they're paying a lower rate in taxes, and that equates eventually to wealth transfer to the top because that increases the value of the stock. The wealthy hold more stock than most people do, so that flows to the top 1% and the top 0.1% and 0.1%. Also in terms of income, going to very high earning CEOs and other senior executives, that as a result of these corporate tax loopholes and breaks has gone way up, also benefiting the top 1%. And then on taxation in general, we see that, for example, the tax rates on billionaires, the absolute highest earners among us, people who might earn $100 million in a year or whatever in today's economy. Now the top tax rate is 39.6%. In the days of Dwight D. Eisenhower, it was more than 90%. In the days of Richard Nixon, it was up in the 60s and 70s. We've let the minimum wage, we meaning in this case our leadership in Washington, have let the real value of the minimum wage shrink down. So all of this is the result of government decisions, and those decisions can be changed.
Richard, maybe you could review for us the top policy changes you think we need to most quickly and effectively change this trend of income inequality in the country. I'll also add into the mix there the problem that we have now after Citizens United, and certainly even before Citizens United, where large amounts of money are flowing into our political system, which obstructs changes that would benefit the majority.
We have this increasingly corrupted political system thanks to Citizens United, thanks to the revolving door that sees people have top elected or appointed jobs in Washington and then go to the very banks and corporations they should have been reining in. So we have all of that. What we have on the other side is enormous public opinion in favor of the kinds of changes we're talking about and in favor of a fair economy. And I'm not just talking about Democrats or independents or young people or self-described liberals. I'm talking about policies that are overwhelmingly supported by Republicans, even self-described Tea Party members, 75% of whom want to see Social Security protected and not cut. Majority of Republicans wanted to see a millionaire's tax. So this is not just a fringe idea. This is what the American people want. So what we have to do is mobilize that sentiment in order to combat the enormous infusion of money into the political system and then demand that our leaders take the money out of the political equation altogether. That's one of the changes we need.
That was Richard Eskow, a senior fellow with the Campaign for America's Future. Find links to more analysis and commentary on income inequality in the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, the weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.